When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, AMS, S&R Remodeling, St. Vincent de Paul, and the Axley Law Firm. Joining us now from his own law firm in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff. Casey, certainly a lot to talk about, but our headline today will be the apprehension of Joseph Jakubowski of Janesville, who a week ago stole guns from Armageddon Supplies. And just for just so people know, they are a sponsor of my radio station, 105.9 The Hog. They are on Janesville's west side. So he took a lot of arsenal. He went on the run. He wrote some manifestos, mailed them. There were threats. Your thoughts on, you know, is this man going to spend a significant amount of time in prison?
Most likely, yes. And he's, you know, he's charged in two different jurisdictions. He's charged by the federal government for taking guns from a federally licensed, you know, firearm dealer.
Oh, so gun stores are federally licensed.
Well, I believe so. At least this one was. And I think my understanding is he can face up to 10 years in prison for that alone. Then what you're also looking at is Rock County has charged him with burglary and arming oneself with a dangerous weapon. That's a Class E felony in Wisconsin, which means that he can face up to 15 years in prison for just the burglary count. Then you add on top of that, he's got a felony theft charge. It's a Class H felony. He can face another 6 years. So you've got 15 plus 6 years. That's 21 years. And then you've also got a Class I felony, which is possession of burglary tools. And that's a that you can face up to 3 years and 6 months. So he faces a significant amount of time in prison. And I think if convicted, especially given the facts of this case, which are, you know, burglary in and of itself, is a crime that often garners prison in Wisconsin. It's not required to. There's no mandatory minimum for it, but it can. And I think under these circumstances, given all the, you know, the chaos that he allegedly, you know, that basically he put everyone through in Wisconsin,
Well, there
all
was the
school shutting down things.
There was the twine wasted with the governor's Easter egg hunt.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
A lot of twine went into that. Let me play now criminal defense attorney, former federal prosecutor, Chris Van Wagner.
Here's how his criminal history plays in federal court. First of all, the fact that he has two felonies on his record, one for disarming a peace officer and one for possession of controlled substance with intent to deliver. He has two felonies. Those two felonies are both considered violent felonies in federal court. So they will use those, if he's convicted, to take his sentence from, you know, the sentence on this charge is a maximum 10 years. This will take it all the way to the top. But if they add counts, he could be sentenced up to as many as 30 years under the federal sentencing guidelines for a career offender.
Delivering drugs is considered can be considered a violent crime?
Well, the way that the feds do it, and you've probably heard about the feds, the federal system operates much differently than the state system.
And yeah, you don't want to go to federal court, do you?
No, I mean, the federal system is almost like they take a lot of different things, you know, career criminals, meaning that you can take, you know, there's all kinds of factors, and I guess I'm not well-versed enough in the federal system because I really practice in state court.
You don't want to go to federal court, right?
Right. Other than the fact that they, you know, they almost use sort of a point type system where they're, you know, they're stacking things up. And judges in federal court has often been criticized where judges are, you know, are able to exercise a little bit less discretion than in state court because there is this system that they have there where they take so many different factors. And it's almost like, you know, plugging things into a computer and trying to find out what the right sentence would be, whereas state court you have generally more variability in sentencing. So although what I would say again about this case is he's facing significant charges in state court alone, and my guess would be Rock County and the prosecutors there are going to take this case very, very seriously. considering, you know, everything that went on with it. So I would be surprised if convicted if he didn't face some very lengthy.
Do they ever adjoin cases like this, or would he serve the time, the twime, as the governor would say, concurrently, or would he have to serve them consecutively?
I don't know how that's going to work because you have two different jurisdictions. My guess would be it would be consecutive, but I don't know.
What about adjoining the cases?
Well, you can't really adjoin. You can't adjoin a state and a federal case mm-hmm. because they're just in two different jurisdictions. So they're going to have plus they're completely different charges. You know, they're completely different statutes. One's uh-huh. under the federal code, one's under Wisconsin statutes. So you can't adjoin them. Unlike you, where you could potentially do that or try to sever them if they were joined, if you had, you know, charges that were in the same county okay. that were somewhat similar.
Okay. So let's take a look at some things that may be in his favor. This ended peacefully. You could not have found a better person to run across him, somebody with some skills in counseling people, a retired teacher.
Who
remarkable. You know, he evidently that teacher didn't know who he was and talked to him for an hour, clearly calmed him down. He went peacefully. You know, we still don't know who transported him out there to get all those weapons. There was no car found. But the fact that he was taken in without any violence, does that has to work in his favor a little bit? And the fact that he's clearly mentally ill, his parents said he wasn't taking his medication, that those would be factors in his favor.
Right. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to prejudge the case. I mean, you know, he may have defenses, especially when it comes to, you know, his mental illness and things like that and what he was actually experiencing at the time. Did he actually know right from wrong? Or was the fact that he was off of his medications and was he experiencing such a sort of hallucinogenic episode that he didn't know right from wrong? I mean, we don't know the answers to those questions. What we do know is, according to the homeowner, he indicated that when he spoke with Jakubowski, Jakubowski told him that, you know, the homeowner was the first guy that basically listened to him. Uh-huh. He was the first guy that really heard him out. And, you know, what I've found in a lot of these types of, you know, when analyzing a lot of these types of situations, it really is oftentimes an issue of mental illness. Now, I'm not excusing his behavior. His behavior, if what's being reported is true, is atrocious and needs to be punished. But, I think that you're right, Sly, that you didn't have to have this massive show of force, a massive show of authority by the police, which you really had as a homeowner that calmed this guy down, and it led to the police being able to capture him without any incident. So, you know, kudos to the police, kudos to the homeowner. You know, I think that the homeowner was really in a position where he was able to make good on this. And those are strategies that police often do use, I mean, you know, and successfully so. And in this situation, it happened to be a guy that had a lot of experience that was talking to Jakubowski.
It is interesting, though, the mindset. You think how paranoid someone would be when they're on the run and the whole world is looking for them. It's literally not national news, but this was covered on Canadian news last night, and I'm guessing it was covered all over the world.
Right.
So the fact that Jakubowski did not could have shot that homeowner, could have taken him out, but he didn't. So I would just say there's, and I don't want you to think I'm feeling particularly sorry for him. He created a lot of disturbance, but I also think we ought to keep in mind is that this is someone who is deeply troubled.
Right. And those are things that are often missed in these situations. I mean, how do we prevent something like this from happening again? And, you know, again, I'm not feeling sympathy for him either, but I am saying that mental health treatment is a real problem. I mean, we need more mental health resources. We need more mental health treatment.
Well,
would that have prevented some,
and we need, like you know, this? And no. We need employers to cover mental illness in their healthcare plans.
Absolutely. And what's exacerbated by this is he apparently wrote a letter to the gun dealer, basically, or the gun shop, saying, you know, I'm sorry, which was sort of interesting. He's saying, I wish that I could afford to buy these legitimately, but I couldn't afford it, and I need to protect myself. I mean, something was going on in his head, it seems to me, that suggests he was clearly disturbed and felt that he was somehow under attack. I mean, his 161-page manifesto that he wrote and all of that, that's the other interesting thing, is some people had said, well, why isn't he being charged federally for his manifesto, because didn't it contain a threat to the president? And from what I have seen, and according to the authorities, I've seen some reports on, I think it was an FBI agent who said that really his manifesto did not contain any specific threat to the life of the president, because if it did, he certainly would have been prosecuted, and there have been people that have been prosecuted.
What about the threats to schools and churches?
Well, they weren't. I don't know that
implicit. They weren't. Were they not implicit enough?
Well, I don't know if they were explicit enough. I think that I'd have to take a look. I'm not sure about the manifesto.
You're right. It would be explicit rather than implicit.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I'm sure authorities are going to be looking at that. But I mean, I think that also is going to be a matter of the state, right? The state of Wisconsin charging that, as opposed to the feds, because the reason that the feds would look at a charge against the president is because he's a federal official, he's a federal executive. But if it comes to threats,
who likes chocolate cake?
Who likes chocolate cake? And if it came to threats though to the school district, that would be a state issue, and people have been charged for that. There are laws that cover. You know, you can't make for example, a bomb threat to a school. I mean, that's a felony in Wisconsin. And so I guess it would depend on the context. I'd have to look at the manifesto in more detail.
You know, some of my friends did that during our school days in middle and high school.
Yeah, well, they may be, if they did that today, they'd probably be in prison.
All right, so this is an interesting case. When you steal high-powered guns, can you be charged? And I don't know if you know this, but in other words, if you take an AR-15, or even if you take, there are, you know, gun stores have certain licenses where they can have fully automatic weapons. I know that because I've shot them. I don't know if he took any fully automatic weapons, but he certainly took semi-automatic weapons and some pretty powerful rifles. Can you be charged federally based on the capacity and power of the weapons that you take?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that the FBI at least was looking in to try to find, because they found some firearms with him in this makeshift tent,
right?
But they didn't find the other ones, and I think that there was some sort of suspicion that there may have been an automatic weapon of some sort that he had taken. I'm not sure about that. I do know that they can charge him and have charged him with the, taking guns from a federally licensed facility. I don't know that it really matters necessarily whether the guns were fully automatic, semi-automatic, or otherwise.
Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff with us at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. We offer guitar repair of the highest quality. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
Returning with Casey Hoff, criminal defense attorney from Sheboygan. We're talking about a variety of cases today at SliceOffice.com. I want to talk to you about this case that happened in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. A young man who actually happened to be a criminal justice student was at his parents' house when it was broken into for the second time in one day. This quiet neighborhood in suburban Tulsa had been targeted recently. Let me play this. This would be the 911 call, I believe. Hopefully I have the right clip here.
Okay, sir, we're getting people out that way. And they attempted to break into your house, and then You shot them, correct?
Correct. They are in my house. Two are still in my house.
Okay. Are they white males?
I didn't really get a good look.
Okay. Can you see them right now?
No, I'm, I shot two of them. Now I'm barricaded in my bedroom.
You're barricaded in your in his bedroom? Okay.
Correct. Southeast corner. They broke in the back door. I can hear one of them talking.
Okay, what are they saying?
I can't hear them.
Okay, where were they shot?
Upper body.
Upper body?
Yes.
Can we send them at the end of 91st and get it fixed? Let's
say, at the intersection
91st
and
41st. I don't want to walk
it. Are you hurt, sir? No. Okay. 2 miles east of the Zico plant, if you guys are having trouble finding it.
We're getting people in or out. And you live in Broken Arrow, correct, sir?
Correct. Just outside of city limits, it's Wagner County.
And you said it was 2 miles east of the Zico plant?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, what did you shoot them with?
They are 15.
Okay.
I'm still armed in the southeast corner of my house.
Okay. Okay, sir, my deputy's on scene. I need you to go ahead and unarm yourself and put the gun away.
You can tell he's a criminal justice student, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to know what he's talking about. You know, and Sly, I think that this is a really interesting case to analyze this whole Castle Doctrine law here in Wisconsin. And as you know, Wisconsin did pass the Castle Doctrine law. Now, I want to be clear about this. You know, I can't give, obviously, any legal advice, so I'm just telling you what the law is. But Wisconsin has always had we've always had the privilege of self-defense. That goes back to our common law. It goes back a long time to the British and even, you know, before that. But the privilege of self-defense under Wisconsin law is a statutory right. So it means that there's a section. It's 939.48. It's not important to know that other than to say that that's the self-defense statute. And it talks about self-defense in defense of others. And what the Castle Doctrine Law did is it specified, it added a section that specified the circumstances where a person claiming that he used self-defense, used force in self-defense, it gave the person what's called a presumption of reasonableness. Okay, so before you had to show, the defendant in bringing a self-defense claim had to show that one.
The onus was on the homeowner.
The onus was on the homeowner to make an initial showing, and they had to show that there was an actual or imminent unlawful interference with their person. Number two, it had to show that he believed that the amount of force he used or threatened to use was necessary to prevent or terminate the interference. Okay, so it was this reasonable belief. You had to have a reasonable belief. Now, the presumption of reasonableness, it goes a long way to satisfy that initial burden. Okay, because then the burden then shifts to the prosecution, and they have to prove that basically the self-defense claim was not reasonable. Okay, and that they were not entitled to self-defense. Now, that presumption does not apply if, for example, somebody's running a drug operation out of their house and using self-defense to shoot somebody that's coming in to buy drugs or to get money from.
Oh, really?
Right?
Interesting.
It does not apply to that. So if you were engaged in criminal activity at the time, or you were using your house or your vehicle or your business to further a crime, you're not entitled to that presumption.
You think it's the time I closed that meth lab in my house?
Yes, you would not be. You would not be. Or if the person against whom the force was used was a public safety worker who entered, you know, police officer, firefighter, something like that, and they were performing their official duties and they identified themselves as such and things like that, then that presumption does not apply. But in Wisconsin, under the Castle Doctrine law, it does. Now, it applies not just to your castle. And by the way, the word castle doctrine is never used in law, so we're just using the shorthand to refer to that. But it's also your car, your place of business. So, you know, it's just the presumption of reasonableness. Again, that's all the law added. And I shouldn't say that's all the law added, because that's a big deal. Because the fact that it added that presumption of reasonableness, which is a rebuttable presumption, meaning you can say, no, it wasn't actually reasonable, but it satisfies that person's burden, uh-huh, I guess, much more easily than it otherwise would.
I take it Oklahoma's had the castle doctrine probably longer than Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if Oklahoma also has the stand your ground law, which is a little bit different and more expansive. Right. But basically says any place you have a public right to be.
Let me play a story from KTUV in Tulsa. The grandfather of one, there are three people killed in this, two of them teenagers, one an adult. There's also a 21-year-old woman who basically put them up to this, told them to go back in the house and get more. She's in big trouble. We should state that Zach Peters was not charged in this case. There was, you know, they had to look at this, but he was not charged in this case. He's the person that used the AR-15 to kill the intruders. This is a story from KTUV.
See here on Tulsa's Channel 8.
What these three boys did was stupid.
Leroy Shoemaker agrees his grandson Jacob Redfern and his friends made a bad decision, but not one worthy of deadly consequences.
They knew they could be punished for it, but they did not deserve to die.
Redfern, 19-year-old Maxwell Cook, and 16-year-old Jake Woodruff were shot by the homeowner's son while breaking into the Wagner County house on Monday. Shoemaker says his grandson didn't have a chance. The 17-year-old, he says, never got into trouble.
Brass knuckles against an AR-15, come on. Who is afraid for their life?
Since the shooting, Wagner County deputies have arrested 21-year-old Elizabeth Rodriguez, the alleged getaway driver. Shoemaker believes she was the ringleader. The homeowner's son has not been charged with a crime, deputies saying they believe he fired in self-defense.
There's got to be a limit to that law. I mean, he shot all three of them. There was no need for that.
Shoemaker does say he is for the right to bear arms and protect your home, but he doesn't agree with shooting and killing intruders.
All right. This castle doctrine and the law, of the common law, being able to defend your home. These people had concealed their faces. Obviously, the homeowner did not necessarily know their level of armament. They were carrying brass knuckles and knives. What's the law state as far as that goes?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to, at least in Wisconsin, we're talking about that a person using self-defense has to show that there was an actual or imminent unlawful interference with their person, that they believe the amount of force that they used was necessary to prevent that unlawful interference. And to obtain the reasonablest presumption, okay, a person that is claiming self-defense that used the force that was likely to cause death, and in this case, certainly the AR-15, I think, you know, I don't think anybody would argue, would be likely to cause death. They have to show that the person against whom the force was used had unlawfully and forcibly entered their dwelling or their vehicle or their business. Okay, under Wisconsin law, I think that's clearly satisfied. Two, that the actor was present at the time. That's clearly satisfied. He was in the house, right? And three, that the actor knew or had reason to believe that an unlawful and forcible entry was occurring or had occurred. That is also satisfied. So, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of Oklahoma law, but under Wisconsin law, it would seem to me that under those circumstances, you'd have a pretty good argument that he satisfied it. And it doesn't make an exception to say, well, but they just had knives or they just had brass knuckles. That's not the inquiry. The inquiry is not, the question is not whether they were, whether they had greater weapons than the other person, the homeowner, did. That's not the point of the castle doctrine. Now, we can have a debate about the castle doctrine and say whether or not it's appropriate in today's society, but I think a lot of people, I think probably most people would agree that, you know, when you're in your house, that is a pretty sacrosanct place. It's a pretty sacred place. And when we're in our homes, that's, you know, that's where we sleep. That's where we raise our kids. That's where we, we expect to have the privacy and reason. It's really one of the primary reasons we have a Fourth Amendment. preventing unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, that applies to far more than just the home, but the home was sort of the impetus for that. Mm-hmm. We don't want law enforcement officers to be able to willy-nilly come into our home without a search warrant.
Let me ask you,
can't, unless there's an exception.
If somebody is breaking into your car in your driveway, does the Castle Doctrine stand?
Well, you have to be in that place.
In other words,
is what I understand it to be, because you have to actually, the actor was present at the time. I take that to mean you've got to actually be in your vehicle.
Okay.
So I, you know,
so you can't. If somebody steps onto your property, and you feel threatened, you can't necessarily shoot them in your front yard.
No, I don't think so, because you have to either have forcibly and unlawfully entered the actor's dwelling, vehicle, or business, or be in the process of doing so. And I don't think you'd be, under the hypothetical you're raising, I don't think you'd be in the process of any one of those three.
Somebody breaks into your house, you feel threatened, you shoot him in the back?
No. I don't think this should be, because although you're entitled to a presumption of reasonableness, okay, if you satisfy those three things or those factors that we laid out, that doesn't necessarily mean that what you're doing is reasonable.
Okay.
So I don't think anybody should take, and I, you know, from talking to various people that deal in self-defense and deal in firearms, I don't think any of them would say, yeah, you just go willy-nilly shoot somebody in the back. I mean, you're still at risk of facing criminal and civil liability. This doesn't erase that risk. It makes it perhaps easier to avoid that. Well, I shouldn't say perhaps. I think it does make it easier because of the presumption of reasonableness, but it doesn't mean that what you're doing is reasonable. Just because you're given a presumption, doesn't mean that if a court looks at that or if a jury looks at that, that they're going to say, yeah, shooting somebody in the back is a good idea. I don't think that was the point.
This Elizabeth Rodriguez, the mastermind behind the robbery, the ringleader who told the teenagers and the young adult to go back into that house, she's being charged in these deaths.
Well, and I don't know specifically what she's being charged with, but in Wisconsin, I would imagine she could be charged with what we call felony murder, right?
Felony murder?
Well, I shouldn't say that. It wouldn't be felony murder. It would be party to the crime of burglary, I suppose, or robbery, I suppose.
She faces a first-degree burglary charge and a second-degree burglary charge, at least so far. But they said that she's also going to be charged in the death, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
She did turn herself in, which probably helped her a little bit. But this is really an interesting case.
Absolutely.
Real quick, I only have a couple minutes left here. Just give me a cursory view of this law and constitutional change called Marcy's Law.
Well, I'm really disturbed by this on a number of levels. First of all, it's obviously a good idea to treat victims of crime with dignity and respect and sensitivity and fairness and all of that. I don't know that many people would disagree with that, and I certainly don't disagree with that. In fact, we have that written into our laws right now. We have victims' rights in Chapter 950 of the Wisconsin statutes. But the idea that Attorney General Schimmel is proposing, that he wants to make victims' rights close to, but not equal to, but close to the same rights as defendants have who are accused of crimes and facing a loss of liberty, I think goes way too far. To elevate this to create a constitutional amendment to put in what he wants to put in, I am very concerned about how that will impact the rights of defendants. For example, he wants victims to have the right to privacy. Does anybody disagree with that in principle? No, that sounds great, and victims should have the right to privacy. But what specifically does that mean? Does that mean that a defendant is not going to have access to the to records relating to the alleged victim? Does that mean that that they're not going to have the right to fully cross-examine and seek and obtain records that could be exculpatory and in their defense? if that somehow conflicts with what a victim views as a right to privacy, I have a huge problem with that. He's talking about being present at bail hearings. They're already allowed to be present. Victims are at any sort of criminal proceedings that I can think of in criminal court. So we already have these rights for victims, almost all of them that I can see here, to be present at proceedings involving the case. I already have that. To reasonable protection from the accused throughout the justice process. I don't know what that means, but if it means that a defendant cannot have contact with an alleged victim of a crime, that's almost always written into a bond condition anyway, and it can subject the defendant to additional criminal charges if they violate that bond. To reasonable and timely notification of the proceedings. We already have that. To confer with the attorney for the government or the prosecutor.
The attorney general is, I've got to go here, but the attorney general is saying that that these are statutory laws in Wisconsin. He feels it's important that they be constitutional.
Well, once you elevate them to a constitutional right that rivals a defendant's constitutional right, then what you're doing is, I think you're creating a lot of potential problems when it comes to due process for defendants. Because when you put those on an equal playing field, and they should never be on an equal playing field, it's not to say that victims shouldn't be treated with dignity, they should. But they should never be put on the same playing field as a defendant who is charged with a criminal who is presumed innocent throughout this process, presumed innocent, unless and until they are convicted, is a very dangerous precedent to set. It goes to the edge of a presumption of guilt as opposed to a presumption of innocence. And that is a foundational principle, the presumption of innocence, in our criminal justice system.
Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff with us. Casey, if you help people all over the state, if you get in trouble, what's your number?
920-234-2222.
All right, Casey Hoff, thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
For more wisdom like that, drive home with Sly on the Big AM 1380 and the Big FM 93.7.
You like that?